Welcome, everyone. Good evening. Bienvenidos y bienvenidas todas y todos. Now, my name is Mary Bell Gomez, and I am your MC tonight. And this is my son, Celine. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Jimmy Padrich to you tonight. And we met 6 years ago when we went to the with the delegation to the social forum in Venezuela. And he is the organizing chair for the National Association of Letter Carriers in Portland area for the last 20 years. And he's the delegate for the carries for the Northwest Oregon Labor Council for the AFL-CIO for the past 20 years. And I'm so excited to say that he's the founder of the Portland Youth with Justice Coalition, and he's a founder of the Portland Labor Committee on Central America and the Caribbean. And he's going to speak tonight.
I know you're all waiting and excited to hear Ava Golinger, but you get to hear me for a couple minutes because Venezuela has a special place in my heart. Venezuela gave me back my hope. Hope that working people could really make great leaps forward in changing their conditions, the working conditions, their living standards, their communities. And before I met the Venezuelan Revolution, I had sort of given up on big changes. I had sort of given in to the triumph of global corporate rule. You know, I'm an old warrior in this battle against the empire. I got started about 45 years ago when I had to make a decision whether I was going to go fight in the jungles of Vietnam to make the world safe for democracy. And I and many of us in my generation fortunately figured out that it wasn't about democracy, it was about defending global corporate rule. And we said no, and we threw ourselves against the war machine, and we were successful in getting the U.S. to withdraw from Vietnam. And we figured that U.S. military intervention was over for good. You know, we had won. And I went, you know, got involved with local union organizing. And then in the 80s, under Reagan and Bush 1, we discovered that there was U.S. military intervention going on in Central America. And this time to stifle, of course, workers and campesinos who were trying to get land and decent jobs. And the slogan back then, the sound bite, was that El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. And we understood that good union jobs in the U.S. were being outsourced to low-wage sweatshops in Central America. We knew that military spending intervening in these revolutions in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala was money that would be better spent in creating jobs in the United States. We even had a recession back then. I don't know if you remember the Reagan recession of the early 80s. I was laid off from my good union job at Safeway and sold my house and took some money to visit Nicaragua. And what I found in Nicaragua was this huge experiment in workers' power and poor people's democracy that everybody was in motion trying something new. Workers were taking over abandoned factories and running them themselves. Even postal workers were running the post office. Unemployed were creating cooperatives. Farm workers were becoming farm owners. It was, I came home all charged up and helped found this Portland Labor Committee on Central America, convinced that we could convince the labor movement to oppose U.S. intervention and support these workers' uprisings. Our slogan was jobs, not war. Of course, we know how that turned out. Our labor movement did come around somewhat, and the revolutions were crushed militarily by the empire. So in the 90s, I just focused on local, you know, helping to found Portland Jobs with Justice and, you know, helping to support, raising the minimum wage and union organizing campaigns and fair contract campaigns. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it looked like the global corporate rule was just going to extend to every corner of the planet. And the U.S. manufacturing base was being outsourced to Mexico and then to China and then to Indonesia. And these free trade agreements were forcing people off the land in Mexico and Central America, and they migrated to the U.S., and it just seems like the empire's race to the bottom was taking our wages and benefits and union jobs into the toilet, and there was really nothing that we could do to stop it. But we kept hearing this little glimmer of snippets of information coming out of Venezuela, that there was this guy, this military guy named Hugo Chavez, who had come to power, and he was just distributing the oil wealth, redistributing it, and that he was supporting poor people's power. And not only that, he was also inspiring other South American countries to resist the empire and was actually leading the derailment of the free trade agreements of the Americas and somewhat disrupting the World Trade Organization's pro-corporate privatization and deregulation agenda. So it was no surprise to find out that Chavez was overthrown in a military coup orchestrated by the empire in 2002. So I thought, oh, well, it's the way it is. The empire is just too powerful. And then 3 days later, the people in the streets turned the military around, and like in Tunisia and Egypt, the revolution triumphed, and Chavez was returned to power. So in 2006, I was asked by the leadership of the Jobs with Justice, Portland Jobs with Justice Coalition, to represent the coalition in Venezuela at the World Social Forum in Caracas. And I said, no, look, find some young person who needs to be inspired. Don't send me. But twisted my arm, and I came back really inspired. I mean, it felt like being in Nicaragua in the 80s again. It was a huge experiment. Everybody was in motion, trying all kinds of new things. And what we found in Venezuela was this... This militant democratic union movement that was spreading throughout the country and challenging government bureaucrats and corporate owners and not dedicated not only to improving wages, hours, and working conditions for their members, but taking control of production and distribution decisions and serving the community and improving the lives of all working people. And we found a government under a new constitution which guarantees not only the right to vote, but the right to participate, the right to hold the government accountable, and the right to affordable food and housing, the right to free health care and education through university, the right to secure retirement, the right to land, seed, equipment, credit, and technical assistance for small farmers and small businesses, especially co-ops. And this is what Hugo Chavez calls the socialism for the 21st century. So far, the empire has not intervened militarily. So far, the millions of dollars that the empire has spent to try to undermine the Venezuelan revolution have not been successful. Fortunately, the revolution seems to be spreading not only to Central America and South America, but in the Middle East, even in Wisconsin. So this can only be good for the working class. But of course, the threat of continued U.S. intervention is very real, especially when we look at the history of U.S. military and covert operations against pro-worker governments and movements in Nicaragua, Grenada, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, Cuba, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Guatemala. And that's just since World War II. So please listen closely to what Ava Golinger tells us about the empire's designs in Latin America. And I hope you will join me in helping get out the word about this awesome experiment in workers' solidarity called the Venezuelan Revolution, and especially to join this old warrior to do what we can to keep this revolution from being strangled by the empire's web. And Maribel?
We are in a refoundation in Honduras, and we are in a revolution, and what Eva is going to reveal to us tonight, you know, we had a coup d'etat in Honduras, and it's very clear the complicity of the United States. And right now, you know, we had in Honduras the conference that is called Honduras is Open for Business. And this is... this is United States plan, and this is as insulting for us, for the people in Honduras, because the name of this conference is in English. Honduras is open for business. It's not even in our own language, and we need to stop the empire. And in Honduras, since the coup d'etat in 2009, and we've been in resisting, and we will continue in resisting, and we are going to start the revolution that we need in Latin America and around the world. And it's an honor for me to introduce La Reina de la Revolución Venezolana, named by Hugo Chavez, Eva Colinger. Yes.
Thank you. Hello. No reina, novia. Me da pena, no digas reina. Ni novia. Okay, well, thank you very much for all those introductory statements. And thanks for the invitation to come here, PSAC, everybody, and to converse and share with you guys tonight about this important topic. I just got into town a few hours ago from Chicago. I did an event there yesterday in a university, and I just got into the U.S. actually, well, I guess 2 days ago, day before yesterday, the evening before yesterday. And I just wanted to comment on the experience of coming back, coming into the U.S., coming into the United States at this moment of time, and turning on the television and seeing the grotesque celebrations of death and war, and an increase in a sentiment of power and dominance around the world that the U.S. and the people of the U.S., not all the people, but a lot of the people, want to continue to impose on others and somehow feel that it's their right to do so. And just how frightening and bizarre it is to witness that and see that and feel it, especially when I live in Venezuela and you live in a place where that's viewed as something that's completely unacceptable and that's being fought against every day. And that, you know, it's scary to see that sentiment again sort of rejuvenated after having lived through it, you know, 10 years ago. Or 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago, when the so-called war on terror began, and this concept of being able to cross borders and assassinate and kill and do whatever, invade countries, intervene in the name of U.S. interests and U.S. power, began a path that seems to have absolutely no end in sight whatsoever, no limit, no boundaries, no defined enemy, where the threat continues to expand and expand and grow and become something, you know, worldwide. And how frightening it is to see that and to experience that and to see how easily the people in the United States fall beneath the spell of U.S. power and celebrate it and feel as though it's something to be proud of. I personally feel ashamed of it. As a U.S. citizen, I feel ashamed of that. And I feel like, and it's, yeah, well, I don't know if that's something to applaud, but these are very scary times that we're living in, and very exciting times at the, you know, in the same moment to see these movements of change taking place in the Southern Hemisphere, where people are, and in Venezuela, actually, this year we celebrate our 200th year of independence. And at a time when that movement for independence is growing and expanding in a way that was unconceivable just a decade ago. And, you know, to see that while that's taking place in the South, in the North, you know, the drums of war are still beating louder and louder every day. And to see also, you know, that to the dismay of many in the U.S., not to some of us, but that a president who gave an image of change, of somehow, you know, altering or modifying a U.S. foreign policy that was viewed around the world as very destructive and very imposing and, you know, viewed in a very negative way, has only worsened the situation. And that personally, I believe that what's happened over the past few days, without having to go into detail about it, everyone knows what I'm talking about, will only further that situation and will only, instead of, once again, as what happened in September 11, 2001, which, for me at least, I thought should have been a moment of reflection, was not a moment of reflection for many, but was rather, you know, a moment of a rapid initiative into war, worldwide war, that again, that's happening. You know, and that now we're seeing a policy of assassination becoming something not only formalized and officialized as being, you know, acceptable, but also being celebrated and applauded. And that it's not something that can only happen against a designated and condemned enemy in the public opinion, but could be pursued against anybody that U.S. interests determine is an adversary or a threat to their interests. And that at the same time, U.S. interests are now perceived as something that, or as a concept that doesn't even belong to the United States. That U.S. interests exist in other nations across other borders just because they're resources, strategic resources that are important to U.S. power. And I say this because Venezuela, of course, is the country now designated officially by a U.S. government agency as the country with the largest oil reserves on the planet. I mean, that's huge. You know, a lot of people don't know that, in fact. But Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, above and beyond those of Saudi Arabia or other Middle Eastern nations. And it's right here. Well, not right. We're on the other side of the U.S., but on the other coast, right below the border. Yeah, it's close. I mean, it's not on the other side of the world. So obviously, that's one of the major draws and attractions of U.S. power towards Venezuela. And Venezuela traditionally has been a country before the Bolivarian Revolution began that was subordinate to U.S. interests. It was a client state of the United States. It's a country heavily penetrated by, you know, U.S. agencies. The Venezuelan state security apparatus was run by the Central Intelligence Agency well through the 1990s. And the Venezuelan armed forces were trained and operated under the doctrine of the U.S. military, of the Pentagon. And, of course, the governments that were in place were subservient to U.S. interests, were allies. Venezuela became one of the major oil-producing nations in the 20th century. In the 19th century, its primary source of income and production was agricultural. But this was all destroyed and abandoned once oil was discovered and the multinationals arrived. And so, you know, it's a country that traditionally has had a very close relation with the United States. When Chavez wins office and the Bolivarian Revolution begins in 1998 to into 1999, everything begins to change. And as you've already heard many things, and you guys know, I pretty much think this is a pretty knowing audience about Venezuela and the at least contemporary history of how the revolution came into place. But what's important to point out is the fact that, yeah, I mean, it was a country that had this close relationship with the U.S., and all of this began to change, and it began to change rapidly. And initially, a policy that was a wait and see, let's just wait and see what happens with this Chavez guy, you know, rapidly became, let's take him out. And in fact, some of the documents that I've obtained through Freedom of Information Act in my investigations early on, some documents from the presidential campaign in 1998, when the campaign had just began, August 1998, there's a State Department document that's been partially declassified, secret document, that specifically says Hugo Chavez is now the leading candidate. He's likely to win, but he should be taken out before that can happen. So they were already talking about, not necessarily that most of it's censored, so we don't know who was actually going to take him out, but they were already talking about assassination as a policy against Chavez, against Hugo Chavez, before he even won. You know, seeing this could become a potential threat. And there are some other documents, actually, from State Department, which are very interesting, from the time period of when the first popular sort of explosion took place in Venezuela in 1989, the Caracazo, as it was known, a reaction to privatization policies and, you know, a mass uprising of poor people in the streets that were then massacred by the government at the time, the neoliberal government at the time, supported by the United States, who subsequently was subject to an attempted overthrow by a military rebellion led by Hugo Chavez in 1992. Some State Department documents referring to that whole scenario talked about the fact that even though that particular government, they themselves in private viewed as one of the most corrupt in Latin America, and that more than 84% of the Venezuelan people were opposed to that government and were discontent with the economic situation, the political situation in the country, because things were, you know, the economy was rapidly going down, declining, the currency was devaluing, poverty was growing at an alarming rate. I mean, nearing the end of the 1990s, it was reaching almost 80%. The U.S. government said, no, we have to do everything in our power to support this government, talking about Carlos Andrés Pérez in the early 1990s, despite recognizing in private that he was corrupt. And there's a famous statement by Henry Kissinger back in the 1970s referring to Salvador Allende possibly winning the elections in Chile, where he said, if we can't control Latin America, how are we going to control the world? You know, if we can't get our own backyard under control, how are we going to be an empire? I mean, it's a logical statement for an imperialist. You know, if we can't get it under control here, we're not going to be able to do it anywhere else. Well, Venezuela was viewed as the Latin America of the world for Latin America, meaning if we can't control Venezuela, how are we going to control all of Latin America? Which is why so heavily what they invested in trying to support governments in Venezuela that were corrupted and, you know, were clearly not chosen by the majority of the people. So when after Chavez comes to power and all of this begins to change and the Bolivarian Revolution starts, you know, there was a concern amongst the U.S. government, but it was inconceivable that these types of changes that we're seeing today could actually take place and that there would be an expansion, of course, throughout Latin America. It was inconceivable. By the end of the 20th century, Latin America was under control, technically, you know, but before 1998, before Chavez won. There were democratic governments implemented throughout the region. They got rid of the dictatorships that they had put into place themselves, you know, the U.S. government, and supported. And, you know, neoliberal economic policies were being implemented throughout the hemisphere. When this begins to change, it was literally, I mean, we're talking about the FTAA, the expansion of NAFTA into the Americas, which was launched in 2001 at a summit of the Americas where President George W. Bush made his premiere in the forum of, you know, Latin American nations, and where Hugo Chavez also made his premiere, and there they were together. And Bush launches the FTA, and Hugo Chavez is the lone hand that, you know, raises and says, no, we don't want that. You know, we reject that. Documents of the State Department talked about that initiative, saying, no, by 2005, there's no question that the FTAA will be implemented throughout Latin America. And in 2005, which was the next Summit of the Americas meeting, which took place in Mar del Plata in Argentina, the FTAA was buried. Because by that time, even though... and that was 2005. I mean, 2005, Evo Morales hadn't even won yet. Rafael Correa hadn't even won yet. I mean, there were, you know, there had been changes taking place, but they weren't nearly as substantial as they are today. But by merely in that 4-year time period, you know, enough had happened, an awakening had begun throughout Latin America that was never going to go back to sleep. And so, you know, the U.S. sort of looked at the situation and thought, well, we need to get it under control. So then we had the series of interventions against Venezuela in particular, because that's where it all began in the 21st century, these revolutions spreading throughout the region, throughout the southern continent, southern hemisphere. And we had the coup d'etat, April 2002. We had an economic sabotage, an oil industry sabotage, a massive media war campaign at the end of that year and into 2003. And then we had a series of electoral interventions that actually have never stopped. But at that time, you know, a heavy funding of political parties, of opposition groups, a growing presence of NGOs that just appeared out of nowhere that were all anti-Chavez, all receiving U.S. government funding as a way to feed a conflict in the country. And in 2004, we had a recall referendum against President Chavez, according to the Constitution, which was won by the Chavez camp, 60-40, landslide victory. After that takes place, there's a change in the policy towards Venezuela. Because at that time, if we look back, and it's important to do this sort of, to, you know, recall the recent history of U.S. intervention, of U.S. policy towards the region. At that time, Venezuela wasn't appearing on any of these famous lists of the U.S. government. You know, the U.S. government puts out lists every year, its own list that it just makes up. They're not, it's not any kind of, it's not United Nations, it's not founded on any kind of international law or criteria, you know, under different conventions of human rights or civil rights or whatever. No, it's the State Department, the White House, the CIA, you know, the intelligence community, the Pentagon, deciding on a political basis, you know, who are we going to classify this year as not collaborating with the war on drugs? Or who are we going to decide is a state sponsor of terrorism? Or who are you going to decide is violating human rights or violating freedom of expression or trafficking in persons, whatever. So they put out these lists every year. So in 2005, it's the first time that Venezuela appears on one of the lists. And at that time, it was the list of countries that don't collaborate with the war on drugs or, you know, counter-narcotics efforts. I think it's officially stated that way. And why did that happen in 2005? Well, 2005 was the year that after a series of investigations had taken place in Venezuela, there was substantial evidence that concluded that the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, was sabotaging Venezuela's counter-narcotics efforts and was actually engaging in espionage and in some cases was drug trafficking. And so the Venezuelan government decided to suspend the cooperation with the DEA. And so the reaction of the United States was, all right, well, then we're going to classify you as a country that's supporting drug trafficking. But it was part of a campaign that began in 2005 to demonize the Venezuelan government. And it really began around that time, even though, you know, there was some of it in the early days of the Chavez administration and with the coup and all that stuff. It really began after 2005. And 2005 is also the year in January, just beginning the year of 2005, that President Chavez officially announced and launched the concept of socialism for the 21st century and said, this is the path that we're taking in Venezuela, saying the dirty word, socialism, you know, announcing it, bringing it back into the sphere of public opinion. And obviously, the changes that were taking place in Venezuela throughout those years. I mean, the social programs talking about the free healthcare system or our educational system, free educational system at all levels, up to the highest levels of education. And all these different social programs that have been evolving over the years and expanding began around that time, 2003, 2004, 2005. You know, so really, I mean, those were the beginning years of the revolution. And the sort of trying to bring it all together and figure out what exactly are we doing? Where exactly are we going? You know, we know we're on a path to social justice, but how are we going to get there? And as that began to happen and as more companies were nationalized based on, you know, strategic important decisions. I mean, for example, in 2007, the Venezuelan government nationalized the National Electricity Company, and the telephone company. Well, they were two companies that had previously been public companies that had been privatized in the early 1990s by that same murderous and corrupt government that was eventually impeached, actually. That president was impeached, ended up fleeing justice and went to, you know, Miami, where recently he passed, to the last day, never going back to face justice in Venezuela, Carlos Andrés Pérez. But companies that had been privatized during that time period, when the whole country was on the path to privatization, when they were on the path to privatizing, in fact, the oil industry, which the oil industry in Venezuela was nationalized in 1976. It's not something that Chavez did. But the Chavez government did, in 2007, nationalize the telephone company, the only telephone company. Imagine if there's one telephone company You know, here you've got competition, bunch of companies, they're privatized, but it's also, it's known as a, it's a public service, telephone, even in the United States, as is electricity, as is gas and other things. But imagine if there's just one company and they have a monopoly on communications, including those that are serving the government, the state. And that that company is owned 80% by a U.S. corporation, Verizon.
Well, here we have three. Two now.
Okay, well, okay, but talking about Venezuela. Owned by a U.S. corporation. And on top of that, it, you know, I mean, they're controlling the communications. They're saying, we're not going to serve such and such neighborhoods or these areas. And also, you know, they, I mean, it's a U.S. corporation. It's a foreign corporation, a country that is known now to have been engaging in different acts of destabilization and aggression. Anyway, the, there was a strategic decision made, the point is, a strategic decision made to nationalize it in the name of basically national security and sovereignty. The telephone company, the electricity company, the same thing. It was a U.S. corporation. In fact, the penetration of the United States as it goes from the intelligence services to the armed forces to basically all of the services that were operating in Venezuela at the time when Chavez won office. So it's been a, you know, a series, a process of trying to get the strategic resources back into the hands of the Venezuelan people as they're necessary to be able to further and advance, you know, the process of change that's taking place and how to further and advance really the development of the country. So as these changes begin to take place, of course, they're affecting powerful interests, right? And there's a reaction from the United States as it increases from 2005 into 2006. 2006 is the year when the U.S. first places Venezuela on another list, the list of countries that don't fully collaborate with the war on terror. It's a list that they made up for Venezuela because it was the only country on the list. And that's the year when they sanction Venezuela, and they prohibit, the sanction is a prohibition of selling any arms, weapons, or any military equipment that uses U.S. technology, not just from U.S. companies, but from any company around the world that uses U.S. technology. And that's a lot of companies. And yeah, it's a lot. I mean, the U.S. military apparatus is the largest in the world. And so even contracts that Venezuela had with countries and companies in places such as Spain or in Brazil or in Norway were cut by the third party, by the United States, because they used U.S. technology. So as the U.S. is accusing Venezuela of not fully collaborating with counter-narcotics efforts, and Venezuela is trying to buy some Super Tucanes planes that monitor drug trafficking activity from Brazil, the U.S. is saying, no, you can't buy those because they use U.S. technology. Yeah, so we're going to further sabotage even your efforts to try to combat drug trafficking. But it was a way to try to disarm also Venezuela's armed forces. At that, again, Venezuela was fully dependent on U.S. military technology. Its armed forces, its military equipment was basically all from the United States. I would say 95% of it. So what did Venezuela do? Venezuela looked to other partners, other countries, companies that weren't subjected to those types of pressures. And the principal one has been, was Russia. And that's when that relationship began, because it's an important fact just to keep in mind, because that's one of the areas in the media where they try to target Venezuela, and it, particularly coming out of declarations coming out of the State Department or the Pentagon saying, you know, Venezuela is starting an arms race. Why are they arming themselves? Why are they buying all this equipment from Russia? Well, basically, they're replacing all their military equipment because they can't even get parts to repair an airplane or a helicopter. That's an F-15 or a Hercules, which are U.S., you know, U.S. military equipment, manufactured equipment. So they've got to replace everything. And again, it is the country with the largest oil reserves in the world, and the U.S. is executing an international war they disguise as, you know, against terrorism, but really for energy, you know, some would say anyway. So in 2006, that scenario begins, and we see this first sort of link with the terror aspect. And it's important because it's something that has evolved significantly since then. I mean, for me, this is a very frustrating, interesting experience. Here we are in, what is it, May 2011, and I've literally been talking about this now for like 7 years. and watching it all happen and analyzing this whole situation and seeing how this type of language and this discourse and this media campaign has been evolving and how frightening it really is, how scary it is to see it all happening and how effective it is, you know, how successful it's been. And so how we see, if we look back to 2006, when they first start to talk about terrorism and Venezuela and Chavez, and now we see how far it's gotten today in 2011, where they're still contemplating right now in the White House whether or not they're going to put Venezuela this year on the state sponsors of terror list. And in fact, there was a bizarre article that was out today in some press out of some news station in Houston, Texas, a press article where they were citing an organization that had complained to the news station because they wouldn't show their documentary that had been approved by it's a Fox News outlet, but a local Fox News outlet. And the documentary is about the danger and the threat of Hugo Chavez. And the organization is called StopHugoChavez.com. I'm serious. It's crazy, but it's true. and the StopHugoChavez.com is part of the Free Venezuela Foundation. Free Venezuela because, you know, we need to be freed, which is ridiculous. But anyway, but just to say that here they are at this time contemplating seriously whether or not they're going to place Venezuela on that list. And it's something that began officially in 2008. It was the Bush administration requested in 2008 that there be an in-depth review of whether or not Venezuela should be placed on that list. The determination was made that Venezuela would not be placed on that list, but not because U.S. policy didn't view Venezuela as that level of threat, but because they couldn't figure out how to still get the oil if they put Venezuela on the list. Because, of course, if you're a state sponsor of terror, according to the United States, all relations are broken. So it's, you know, it's an evolving issue, and they're still trying to figure it out. And just last year, in late 2010, the U.S. Congress renewed and modified the sanctions against Iran. And now included in the sanctions against Iran is, you know, and these again are unilateral sanctions. It's a law of legislation of the U.S. Congress. They say that no country or no company can sell gas to Iran. So last October, during a visit to Iran, there were agreements entered into between Venezuela and Iran for the sale of gas. And immediately, the U.S. Congress sent a letter to Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, saying, if you go through with those sales, we will freeze all your assets in the United States. And that includes 7 oil refineries and the entire Citgo gas chain, right? So, I mean, here we see how they're again trying, and then using that as an excuse to say, look, Venezuela is collaborating. You know, this is a new concept that's now being expanded in the United States of what exactly does it mean to support terrorism. It's no longer just necessarily funding it or arming it, but it could be through some other means by providing a so-called terrorist organization, terrorist or state sponsor of terror, with some kind of means or asset that will enable them to continue with their terrorist efforts. It's very vague and ambiguous, I know, and expansive and scary because it could include absolutely anything. So here they are trying to get Venezuela on that angle. And then, of course, the biggest one, which is one that has come out some in the documents that have been released through WikiLeaks, which is the relationship with the FARC from Colombia and how they've been trying incessantly now for years to make the link between some kind of material support from the Venezuelan government, the Chavez administration, to the FARC in Colombia to then say, again, you know, here Venezuela is sponsoring terrorism. Of course, they haven't been able to make the link directly. And in fact, it's been negated by several of the key people involved in those types of investigations, including the head of Southcom, the Southern Command of the Pentagon, who has said repeatedly, well, we think it's happening, but we don't have any evidence of it. Yeah, right. That seems to be one of their excuses to do a lot of really bad things. But anyway, so there's the attempt to try to make this link with terrorism in order to further justify aggression against Venezuela. And as we've seen, also to justify the aggression against Venezuela and using that as an excuse has been including more so recently, once Obama took office in 2009, an expansion of U.S. military presence in the region. And this is directly linked to that alleged so-called threat that they perceive. And so we have, one, the military agreement that was entered into between Colombia and the United States that was officially signed by Obama, in fact, in 2009, which some think has been temporarily stopped, but it, in fact, it hasn't. And it's the U.S. is actively right now occupying military bases in Colombia for allegedly what the, you know, their public version is to combat counter-narcotics efforts. But some documents from the U.S. Air Force that were in the public realm that we uncovered in 2009, from 2009, May 2009, the justification, it was called a budget justification document of the U.S. Air Force, talking about a $46 million request to improve the installations of one of these bases that the U.S. government plans to occupy in Colombia. And included in that included in the justification was a statement, one talking about how they would engage from that base, from Palenquero, Colombia, in full spectrum operations throughout the continent, talking about South America. You know, full spectrum operations are not counter-narcotics efforts. They're war efforts. In fact, they talked about expeditionary warfare and combating the threat of anti-U.S. governments in the region, which can only be the ones, you know, east of Colombia and south, which are Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, some of the nations that comprise ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance of the Peoples of Our Americas. And so there we saw clearly, and in fact, this is actually, I'll tell this little story, because the document, I found the document, right? This U.S. Air Force document. We make it public in Venezuela. Chavez talks about it. I wrote some articles about it. It begins to circulate everywhere. And within a two-week period, this was the documents from May 2009. You can find it because I put it on a website. And then because they took it down. And we published it in November 2009. Early November, like November 6, 2009, within two weeks, the document disappears from the U.S. Air Force website and a new one appears. And it's called an addendum to the prior document. And they took out all the language referring to full spectrum operations, expeditionary warfare, and anti-U.S. governments. And only thing that was left in the document was, you know, this is all, the only purpose of our expanding our presence on this military base is for counter-narcotics efforts. I mean, it was actually really incredible that one, that they would think we're so stupid, you know, that, wait, we saw the original document. Now they're going to put out a new one and say, no, this is the real document. We're not going to forget about the other document. And then because what happened was the document caused a lot of tension in the region. And there was a whole meeting that was convened by UNASUR, by the Union of South American Nations, in which Venezuela was the sort of key player there with the document, talking about, you know, the threat of this agreement between Colombia and the United States and what it meant for the region, and particularly for those countries that, you know, perceive that the threat was against them, those that comprise ALBA, but also the whole region. In fact, every nation in South America, with the exception of Colombia, was opposed to that agreement. And so what happened was, you know, after Uribe left and Santos came to power and there was a whole court case about this military agreement, the Constitutional Court of Colombia determined that the agreement was illegal and therefore was null and void between the United States and the Colombian government because it didn't go through a congressional review in Colombia, which is something that President Uribe tried to avoid. And so he did it directly, you know, whatever. But despite that court ruling, the agreement has still gone through. And we know this because, one, people on the ground who know that the U.S. is actively occupying those bases, but also because the Pentagon's budget for this year includes the monies to improve installation in several of those bases. So we know that they're operating there. We know that it's going on. We know that there's still this expanding U.S. military presence in the region, and we know that it's not just attributed to counter-narcotics efforts. Just as the same goes for the expanding U.S. military presence and talking about we're open for business, not just Honduras, but Panama, which is the other country that had successfully, you know, gotten a lot of the U.S. military presence out of its nation in 1999 when the U.S. left Howard Air Force Base and handed over control of the Panama Canal, technically, to the Panamanian government. And now that there's a new president in power, well, as of 2 years ago, Martinelli, who's a right-wing businessman, millionaire, he went before the United Nations and I guess it was 2 years ago after he had first won office, and he made a statement, he made that statement saying, Panama is now open for business. And what's happened since then? 11 military bases or installations throughout Panama are now being occupied by U.S. forces. So we're seeing a growing presence there. We're seeing a growing presence in Colombia, a growing presence, of course, in the whole Caribbean region, because remember that a large portion of the Caribbean is still colonized by different nations, not just the United States, but a lot of European nations, France, Holland, England, and their NATO countries.
NGOs?
Well, but by nations that use the Caribbean islands as operating bases for their military forces for different, you know, they use them for exercises and stuff like that, but still they've got military presence there. There's a military power, a growing military power in the region that we haven't seen since at least the times of the Cold War, if not before then. The reactivation of the U.S. Fourth Fleet of the Navy, which took place in July 2008, which means also a redistribution of resources, of Pentagon resources, to the region of Latin America. The Fourth Fleet is the fleet that commands and operates in Latin America. It was deactivated in 1950. It was reactivated in 2008. I mean, you can only think, why would they do that? The only reason, and in fact, the commander of the Fourth Fleet, when it was reactivated, they had a whole ceremony celebrating U.S. power, said, we're here again to show the force and the power of the U.S. military, and that we're here to protect and defend our allies. Right? So it's very clear that, you know, again, they're trying to establish this presence in order to demonstrate and to try to recuperate U.S. influence in the region in front of what they see or with regards to what they perceive as a threat. And that's the truth. I mean, they perceive a threat to U.S. influence in the region, and there certainly is a threat to U.S. influence in the region because U.S. influence in the region has been rapidly deteriorating, which is something that's been very good for the peoples of Latin America. And then in the case of Honduras, we've seen that after the coup d'etat against President Zelaya in 2009, which in some part had to do not only with his political relations with the countries of ALBA and with Venezuela particularly, but also with regards to a very strategic and important U.S. military base, which is Sotocano, which the U.S. has occupied since the 1950s and has served as their base of operations. It's the military base that John Negroponte ran all the dirty wars during the 1980s out of, where they trained all the death squads and the paramilitaries that operated throughout Nicaragua and Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. And in 2009, just before, months before the coup, Zelaya had made the decision to turn that base into a civilian airport, because the airport outside of Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras, is a smaller airport, and there had been several plane crashes there. And they needed to expand they needed a larger airport for the growing relations that Honduras was conducting also with other countries in the region. And so the decision was made to use that air base, which is 90 miles or so, maybe a little bit more outside of Tegucigalpa, and turn it into an airport. And so that meant that the U.S. military was going to have to get out, move somewhere else. And he offered another base. He wasn't saying get out of the whole country. He offered another base to them, but it wasn't as strategically located as Sotocano. And on top of it all, who was going to help Zelaya and Honduras turn it into an airport? None other than ALBA, who gave a foundation, the countries of ALBA, gave a fund in order to make that happen. So, you know, there's some speculation that that had something to do, and, there's no coincidence that that's actually the base that Zelaya was taken to right after he was kidnapped and taken out of his home in the early morning hours of June 28th, 2009, was taken to Sotocano, which is run by the U.S. military, and from there he was flown to Costa Rica under the auspices of the U.S. military and the authorization of them as well. And now what do we see? Now that Zelaya is out of the picture, this year in the budget for the Pentagon, 2011, is a $10 million fund to improve the installations of Sotocano. So clearly they had plans in the works to continue expanding their military presence, not just in Colombia, but also throughout Central America. And that this clearly has to do, and also last year, 2009 into 2010, there was a military agreement entered into between Costa Rica and the United States. This is crazy. This is totally crazy. A military agreement that would allow 7,000 U.S. Marines to enter Costa Rican territory and over 64 warships, including aircraft carriers, in order to conduct counter-narcotics efforts. I mean, come on, that's an invasive force entirely, you know? And Costa Rica remember, is a country that has a law against having armed forces. They don't even have their own armed forces. They have a police force. They don't even have their own armed forces, yet they would allow 7,000 uniformed U.S. Marines to occupy their territory. So all of this has clearly been perceived as a growing threat to countries in the region, particularly Venezuela, which is surrounded by those bases. If you can imagine the map of South America, Venezuela is at the top. It's the port. There's the Caribbean, you know, Central America, Colombia, next to Venezuela, military bases everywhere there, growing military presence. And if we look at just a recent case of a country that was not on the radar of being the next subject of any kind of military attack or invasion, that within a matter of hours was attacked, was bombed, was surrounded by military power, I'm talking about Libya, is a country that also was in a situation where it was surrounded by U.S. military bases and U.S. military power and U.S. military presence, that can be rapidly activated in the case that it's necessary to do so. And how frightening that is. And even though I've kind of gone off of track a little bit talking about this, about the military presence, but it's really important because it's actually something that, even though many people think it can't happen, can happen. I mean, a lot of people think, and even in Latin America, but particularly in the United States, would think, no, the U.S. government's not going to invade a Latin American country. When would it ever do that? Right? Well, people have a short-term memory. It's true. Panama, 1989, you know, bombed, invaded, people killed thousands. Grenada, a tiny, teeny little island just because it had a socialist revolution and the Cuban doctors were there giving medical care to the people and educating. It was invaded, bombed, political assassination. And Libya. Libya, a country that had relations with the U.S., you know, and regardless of, again, another demonization campaign or, you know, with not getting into the details. I was there recently. I was there on a trip with President Chavez. We were there, last October. In a country, just to give an example, where there everybody was living their lives normally, you know, doing their business, whatever, their politics, families, kids going to school, going to playgrounds, shopping, doing whatever you do, driving around. Now it's a country under siege. In a matter of months, that nobody expected that, you know? Nobody expects that could happen from one day to the next. And nobody would have thought, nobody would have imagined, even in January of this year, that would be happening today, right? So it's important to always reflect on the fact that can happen. And when you look at how there's been a buildup around Venezuela and countries that, you know, well, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and throughout Central America, we see this military buildup, and we see that, well, it must have a purpose somewhere. And it may never be activated. It's just there in case it's necessary. At the same time, there's been an increase in another one of the major tactics that's been employed in order to destabilize and to feed a conflict, an ongoing conflict, and not just in the case of Venezuela, but also in the case of other countries throughout the region, actually throughout the world, but talking about Latin America, which is the use of the funding, you know, the channeling of resources through different U.S. agencies, foundations, and facades of NGOs that are then feeding a conflict in the country. And I mentioned before this proliferation of NGOs in Venezuela after the coup and around the time of the coup in 2002. And there are some State Department documents from early 2002, before the coup took place, January 2002, where, in fact, the State Department requested that the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, which some know as a humanitarian fund, but it actually is not. It's engaged now in the business of what they call democracy promotion, which is another method of regime change. And at the time, USAID was not operating in Venezuela at all. And the State Department requested USAID, but not just any division of USAID, visit Venezuela, but the division that's called the Office of Transition Initiatives, you know, transition. So this is early January 2002. The head of the office goes down to Venezuela, and he does an assessment, evaluation. He's there for 9 days, and he writes up a report. And the decision is made that we need to employ a rapid force with liquid funds down here to aid civil society and the media, right? I mean, they determined, look, the situation is desperate. We need to get this guy out of power. We're talking early January 2002. And what we need to do with U.S. funding and U.S. support is aid the growth of the what they like to call civil society, you know, which is whoever is going to work to support U.S. agenda in the country, and the media component. And, I mean, the truth of the matter is, after that, USAID sets up its so-called Office of Transition Initiatives in Venezuela several months later. The coup takes place, you know, and then we see, after the coup is overthrown and defeated by the people of Venezuela, we see then a growth of U.S. funding in the country, and all of a sudden this expansion from, at the time when National Endowment for Democracy, which is one of the other key funders, you know, a congressionally founded entity that has the mission of promoting democracy around the world, funding the groups that participated and executed the coup in Venezuela in 2002, it was about a dozen, 15 groups that they were funding, and between political parties, unions, you know, business-associated groups, and NGOs. Well, by the time USAID sets up its office, they began funding around 60-some organizations, and then it's up to, by 2010, over 650. And the majority of them didn't exist before 2002. And we know this because, well, I mean, yeah, we know for a fact. They were organizations that were created to channel funding. They're facades. And most of them, in fact, are organizations that are virtual, that don't even have a physical presence. So it's literally a strategy of, you know, how can we get more and more money into the country in order to continue to feed this conflict and to try to help an opposition grow and consolidate. And it's a strategy that's been employed around the world, you know, as a very effective strategy in many cases. In fact, in the case of the coup in Honduras, the groups that were involved in that coup of the so-called civil society were all receiving USAID funding and National Endowment for Democracy funding, as is the case of Bolivia, as is the case of Ecuador, as is the case of other countries in Latin America, but particularly those are the ones that have been targeted most of all, where we've seen this growth of funding coming out of USAID, National Endowment for Democracy, organizations like Freedom House, International Republican Institute, National Democratic Institute, amongst others, who are used as filters to channel your taxpayer dollars down to organizations that then will promote U.S. agenda to try to destabilize or undermine democracies and the popular wills of peoples throughout Latin America and the world. And I hate to say this because I know you made some very important statements, but the same has happened in several of the countries in the Middle East that have had recent revolts or, you know, uprisings. Many of the organizations or key leaders involved have been and have had close ties to these U.S. agencies. And it's something, you know, to look at because, especially in the case of, obviously, if we look at Syria, Iran, Libya, we see there's a direct link to those entities that have been involved in uprisings against those governments, which are not favorable to U.S. interests, you know, have been closely connected to U.S. agencies. And that's a strategy that, you know, in over time in Venezuela, even though they haven't achieved their goal, has maintained the opposition alive to a large part. You know? And that we've seen millions and millions of dollars. And in fact, there have been several things that we've actually achieved through our work and through denouncing this situation and through working against it. One is, well, first Bolivia. In Bolivia, after investigating and determining what USAID was doing, and in fact, USAID in the case of Bolivia has had an official agreement with the Bolivian government since the 1960s, and mainly to engage in development work. That was what it was originally for, not democracy promotion. Large portions of those funds, in fact, 75% of the funds that were coming in, we're talking about over $100 million a year from USAID to Bolivia, after Evo Morales wins office in 2006, a large portion of those funds, around 75%, were all of a sudden, you know, directed towards political activities and funding separatist movements and penetrating indigenous communities. And so the, you know, Bolivian people very astutely determined that this was happening and in several communities began to protest USAID's presence. And so it got up to the level of the president, of Evo Morales, and he decreed that no foreign funding could be given for political activities in the country, and if it was, you know, they would expel those agencies from the country. And in several municipalities throughout Bolivia, the peoples themselves determined that the work that USAID was doing and the National Endowment for Democracy was undermining not only their sovereignty, but their rights and their will, their popular will, and they expelled them. They expelled USAID from their municipalities. And then Evo Morales made the decision officially to do it from the country. It's really important. It's a huge development. And of course, we know, you know, that there's also now, and actually all three of the countries, now that I'm thinking about it, in Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia, there are no U.S. ambassadors. They've been, all of them have been either expelled or for some reason, like in the case of Venezuela, there's a little diplomatic spat going on about the ambassador that they had proposed. And so there's no U.S. ambassador. And then they kicked out the Venezuelan ambassador. They revoked his visa politely so that he couldn't come back. So, you know, there, and Bolivia also expelled the DEA as well, along with Venezuela in 2005. Yeah. I mean, these are key achievements that have been made based on, you know, the fact that they've uncovered this type of destabilization techniques taking place in their countries. In the case of Venezuela, finally, after all these years of doing this work and of trying to figure out a way to control the situation of the foreign funding coming in particularly, because it's something that's been key, again, in feeding the conflict. In December of just last year, a law was passed to prohibit foreign funding of political activities in Venezuela. And finally, and so what happened? USAID, this was pretty amazing too. The USAID office, the Office of Transition Initiatives, which had been present in the country since 2002, as I said before, all of a sudden left. Picked up and left, but they weren't scheduled to leave because they had already been in the budget for this year, and in fact had, according to their public documents, were at least set to stay till around 2013 in Venezuela. But after we got the law passed, they left the country. Of course, so they left the country, and in fact they put up on the website, because I monitor this stuff all the time, they say the program has officially ended, something like that, you know, and so print out the website, we took it on TV in Venezuela, and you know, we're all talking about, yeah, we got USAID out of here, this is great, they left town, we got our love of a... The next day, within 24 hours, they changed the website, and it says, no, you know, we haven't ended our Venezuela program, it's just now operating out of the United States. Like, we've just transferred the operations out of the country. Of course, because there's a key problem. How are they going to get the money to the people now? Now it's prohibited by law. Now they know that they're closely monitored more so than ever before. What are they going to do? A few weeks later, in January of this year, there was a meeting held by some of the leaders of NGOs in Venezuela, the opposition NGOs, and key figures in the State Department and some Congress members of Congress, where they were trying to figure out, what are we going to do? How are we going to get the money? Especially because Venezuela has presidential elections in 2012. So how are we going to get the money down, you know, for the campaign and to fund our groups? And they were brainstorming over several ideas, which they'll probably try to do. One is using the concept or the figure of prizes, awards. You know, oh, we'll just award this guy over here $500,000 for whatever, you know, trying to figure out a way to get money. And they've done it already. They do it all the time. But they did it in the case of, there was this young student who, young guy, not even 22 years old, just graduating university, who led a student movement against President Chavez in 2007. And it made the headlines internationally. Fox News came down, and they embedded some reporter in with them and all their protests with a head camera to make it seem like it was like a, you know, a war field battleground taking place. And, you know, these student activists were out there in the streets, and there was, yeah, a lot of their protests got violent, so there was some exchange with police forces and tear gas and stuff like that. It made international media trying to portray the Chavez government as repressing, you know, students fighting for democracy and freedom and their rights. So as it turns out, the guy leading the young guy leading the student movement, John Goycochea, who was like applauded around the world and sent on, you know, international tours to give talks everywhere, Europe and throughout the U.S., was awarded, just a few months after that, a $500,000 prize from the Cato Institute. It was the Milton Friedman Prize for Economic Freedom. Like, to a guy who, in fact, had just graduated as a lawyer. He wasn't even an economist, let alone had he done anything for economic freedom. So why are they giving him $500,000? So he takes the $500,000 and he sets up an institute in Venezuela, which he has. It's a legitimate way, of getting money to feed the conflict. Sets up an institute that's now training other youth and students in tactics of basically regime change. Yeah. So, I mean, these are effective methods of getting the money in. Using one of the other things that they talked about was, right, just funding university programs, which the State Department already does in Venezuela and in other countries, but to get the money in there, or using third parties, other embassies, other countries, foundations out of Europe to get the money into groups in Venezuela. So these are, and then of course the old-fashioned way, which is through the diplomatic attachés, the valet, the suitcases, bringing the cash in and just distributing it. Flooding the market in Venezuela, also where we have currency controls, so to avoid capital flight, bringing foreign currency in, it has to be controlled, it has to be regulated. And so they try to also flood the market, flood the black market as well, and get the currency out there and use it as a way to destabilize and sabotage economically in the country. So these are things that are increasing. And on top of all of that, Barack Obama already requested in his 2012 budget, federal budget of the United States government, a $5 million fund to fund groups in Venezuela, officially in the budget, which is something that's totally outrageous. Can you imagine, how can you justify in a budget of this country, like its national budget, funding millions of dollars to political groups in another country? Who cares what country they're in? Just in general. That's just crazy. Not to mention that at the same time he's cutting back all kinds of other social programs and public spending. Yeah, in the United States. But so here we see already the vision of, 2012 presidential elections in Venezuela. We need to make sure that we've got funding going on and set up for the opposition, for those that can oppose Chavez and try to get him out through some kind of legitimate way. So there's been an increase in these different strategies, in the military presence, the threat, the capacity, the funding, the subversion, the feeding the conflict, the trying to unite, as they've done successfully in the case of Nicaragua, at least back in the first Sandinista revolution, to consolidate an opposition movement that could take out or somehow effectuate regime change through a so-called legitimate means. These kinds of, either if it's, it could be through a legitimate electoral process if they were able to do it, or something along the lines of the Honduras situation where they tried to justify that coup against Zelaya through some kind of constitutional, means, saying that it was a constitutional coup, which is totally bizarre. Things like that. So we've seen an increase in that. And then, of course, one of the other most important angles, which you guys probably know very well, which is the demonization campaign in the media and what we've seen in public opinion and how severely dangerous that is, because it's used as the justification then for any kind of aggression against that government. And to get on, since it was mentioned in the flyer, the WikiLeaks thing, other documents that have been obtained by WikiLeaks that refer directly to Venezuela, there's one in particular that I like, which is from 2007, and it came out of the U.S. Embassy in Santiago, Chile, and it was written by, I don't know if he was the ambassador, he must have been the ambassador there at the time, or one of the high-level diplomatic officials in the embassy, Craig Kelly, who's now one of the assistant subsecretaries of state of the Obama administration, who played a key role in the coup in Honduras. He wrote the document, and it was titled Containment Plan for Hugo Chavez. And it was all about their media campaign, basically, of how to control the influence of Hugo Chavez, not just in Latin America, but throughout the world, and how it outlined, a whole plan of of employing different and working with different media throughout Latin America, you know, to promote these concepts and about Venezuela and about the Chavez government being linked to terrorism or drug trafficking or corruption or, you know, oh yeah, they talk about all kinds of stuff like we need to play up and exaggerate, you know, the defects of his government and look at what is not working and make sure that that's what's exploited, you know, and demonstrate in media, as well as trying to convince other governments regionally and internationally to take a more hostile stance against Venezuela. Reaffirming what we already knew, you know, that there was this coordinated campaign going on of demonization, which is one of the first steps taken before a country or an individual is targeted by U.S. power, is to fully demonize them. And you know that that's happened in the case of Chavez. All you have to do anyway is open the paper, look at, turn on any TV station, and even amongst those that are so-called progressive. NPR is actually a very distorted voice on Venezuela, to say it in a more elegant way. But it's really unfortunate, and I think not only is it due to their own lack of investigative work to try to figure out the truth, but also the support that they receive, excuse me, from foundations and those that are linked to this empire's web, unfortunately. Because remember, Venezuela is a key target of U.S. interest because not only of its oil, but also because of this successful threat of a good example that is being built and is growing. And despite all the, you know, I mean, it's not perfect, believe me. There are incredible things taking place, but there are a lot of problems. It's a human process. It's a patient process. It's a process that's constantly reviewing and reflecting on its own steps and advances and failures made, which to me is the best part of it all, is the fact that, you know, nothing is taking place at any kind of pace that's imposing or excluding, but it's an inclusionary process that's in constant review, you know, and that's trying to take the steps that we take as humans, you know, in a collective sense. And this is something that's very threatening. I mean, coming here in a moment when, for example, it was just May Day, right? May 1st. Well, in Venezuela, what happened on May 1st besides big marches and stuff? Chavez announced 25% increase in the minimum wage, 45% increase in salaries for public administration, you know, public employees, an increase in benefits for food benefits. We have a program that public employees get in Venezuela where you get a monthly stipend just to buy food on top of your salary. And that's by law. And now the government has expanded that to the private sector. So now private companies also have to give that to their employees above the salary. You know, these are benefits that are guaranteed. He also, days after that, raised salaries for university workers at all levels, increased funding for public universities, to, you know, for cafeterias and whatever needs to be done in the different universities. All kinds of steps being made to try to improve the lives of workers and the people of Venezuela. You know, when at the same time coming here to this country at a moment when, you know, there are protests underway because of cuts in wages and salaries and benefits and freezes on public spending, the threat of a good example. The fact that in a country that's not as developed, you know, or first world is the terms that they like to use, as the United States, can do those things and can do them successfully. And yes, we have oil and we have the oil wealth, but that's not the only reason why. I mean, the U.S. has got money too, you know? Yeah, just poorly spent, or spent in ways that don't benefit the majority of people. And then, of course, one of the other major threats that Venezuela and countries now comprising ALBA and other nations involved in Latin American integration represents is precisely this concept now of a multipolar world. A multipolar world is a world where countries interact based on respect, sovereignty, integration, and cooperation. Equality. On equal terms. How can we mutually benefit each other? And that this is a concept that's now been growing throughout the region. We have very exciting things taking place this year, July 5th, which is Venezuela's Independence Day. Coincidentally, right after July 4th, we celebrate the 200 years of independence, is the day that the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations is launched. Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC in Spanish. This is a new regional entity that was proposed by Venezuela and has been accepted by every country in the region. Of course, the U.S. and Canada are excluded. They are not invited to participate. And it will be officially launched on July 5th of this year in Caracas, Venezuela. All heads of states, countries are expected to come and participate. And it's a new regional entity that is expected really to take the place of the Organization of American States, which is basically perceived by most in Latin America as a, you know, a colonial representation of U.S. power in the region. So this is incredibly exciting that this is happening and that, you know, this is further advancing not just Latin American integration, but then that this entity can also be used as a way of linking with other regions, as ALBA has been or UNASUR has been to date, you know, where not just is integration taking place and cooperation and this concept of multipolarism throughout Latin America, but also with other countries, which is one of the most frightening things to the United States. That Venezuela or Bolivia or Ecuador, or Nicaragua, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay are engaging in relations directly with China, with Russia, with Iran, with India, with other countries without the U.S. hand in the middle, you know, without the U.S. involvement. And that this is changing the balance of world power. Changing the balance of world power. In a multipolar world, there cannot exist an empire. It's impossible. So this is a direct threat to U.S. power, which is one of the reasons why they're rapidly escalating the aggression and the initiatives to try to neutralize what's taking place, which is why we saw a desperate trip made by Obama a couple months ago to the region, or a month and a half ago, you know, meeting strategically with the president of Brazil, the president of Chile, and then in El Salvador, in an effort to try, you know, to undermine what's taking place, as has been the relationship between the United States and Colombia, which some question what's been taking place between Venezuela, between Chavez and Santos, you know, the relationship between Venezuela and Colombia, which has been a relationship that's been very tense over the past few years, that's now in a process of mending, of, you know, trying to reintegrate itself, which is really something that's very important because the U.S. government has had a strategy of trying to create regional divide. You know, if you keep the countries divided, if you try to pit them against each other, they can't integrate, there can't be unity. You know, then the U.S. influence will continue to reign. And so the concept is, no, we're not going to let this happen. You know, despite differences, and believe me, big differences between some of the nations, what's most important is that that unity first exists, despite those differences and conflicts that could also exist at the same time. To be able to really fulfill that concept, and, you know, we talk about it's not just the Venezuelan revolution, it's the Bolivarian revolution. The concept and the dreams and the ideals of Simón Bolívar, who was the great liberator of nations in South America and the Caribbean, and who had this dream of La Patria Grande, you know, our integrated and unified continent or region of Latin America that's founded on principles of social justice and equality and sovereignty. And, I mean, it gives me chills thinking about this and talking about it right now, because it's incredible to think about the fact that this visionary from 200 years ago who led and achieved that initial independence in Venezuela, that those ideals and those principles 200 years later are still actively being built and enacted and implemented in the region and have now been, you know, rejuvenated, resuscitated, and that we see them and we're living them and we're creating them. And that this is something that has now become an example, and here we are talking about it in the United States, in Portland, Oregon, has become an example and an inspiration for the world. That, you know, another model can exist, that you can build it, that you can have a model based on dignity, which is the most important right to me in the new Venezuelan Constitution of 1999, the right to a dignified life. Thanks. Can I take questions?
You're going to take questions, but I need to give a...
Okay. You have to give a talk? Speech? Should I move? Should I go sit down?
No, you stay right there. Hey, this is going to be short. I'm just my name's Dan Shea. I'm with Portland Central American Solidarity Committee. I'm also with Veterans for Peace, and I'm glad that you talked about the military and its intervention over the years in Latin America. My father was born in Panama. My grandmother was Panamanian, so Latin America has always been a strong influence on me. In the 1980s, as a Vietnam veteran who came back, and I served in 1968 in Vietnam, and when I came back from Vietnam, the war and the effects of war that affected me began to, I didn't question right away what that was going on. But later, the wars continued to trouble people, come back into your lives. I was a victim of Agent Orange. My son was born with a number of anomalies, and at the age of 3 had to go for heart surgery and died. And then when he died in my arms after 7 weeks in a coma, I began thinking about all the things that you're talking about social justice, about all the children that, it's not just talking about governments, these are people. Every single person has a child, a family, a father, a mother, and they are affected by this. And I began to wonder, how could I as a human being be a part of a nation that raised money to kill other people's children around the world? And I began to start thinking about what was happening. I was hearing of refugees coming back from 1980 being involved in, our U.S. military being involved in supporting interventions in Nicaragua and El Salvador and in Guatemala. And just recently, like you said, Obama was down in Central America. He was there at in El Salvador, and he was, you know, talking about Oscar Romero. He went to his grave as though paying tribute to him. How dare he? You know, how dare he go there and say that when he's continuing to do the same thing in Latin America? A friend of mine who now lives in Portland, whose daughter was on the steps when the military of the church where Oscar Romero was, and these jeeps ran up as these guys jump out with the cars, ran over her arm, took off her arm. These are the people that are continuously being affected. Well, PCAST became a part of my life back in the 1980s when Ben Linder, who's from Portland, went down to Nicaragua. And from then on, I've been on off with them and Veterans for Peace on these issues. And they've been, I think, a threat of a good example. And I think if we want that threat of a good example, we need to build a movement in this country. It's not about just supporting a movement in another country. It's about building one here. And a lot of the people here have put in their time, their effort, and money out of their own pockets because we don't have a budget. The right wing is sending money down. This government is sending money down to destabilize those countries that they object to. But they are destabilizing us through our wages and through the institutions that we have available to seek justice. So if we can't depend on them, we have to depend on ourselves. So I want to ask you to give more. You came here, you've contributed, but if you can, there's some envelopes for those who don't have any extra cash. We're going to pass the hat. We're going to have Maribel's son carry the hat and pass it through the line. If you have a few extra bucks in your pocket, please give that, because we need to build a movement here. We need to make PCAST strong. We need to get more people involved. And if you can't do that now, we have some envelopes in some of the pews here. You can reach in. You can make a pledge. Send the check in. Get involved with PCAST. Get involved with your local groups. It's so important that we build these kind of movements. Thank you.
People are always asking me in Venezuela, so when is revolution going to happen in the United States, huh? Come on, guys, get it together. Yes.
I'd like to know your opinion on the causes and the effects of the inflation in Venezuela.
Well, I mean, first of all, what's important to point out is that inflation, as bizarre as it may sound, has actually decreased under the Chavez administration. the Chavez, during the time that the past, well, I guess we talk about 10 years, inflation has decreased by over 65%. And even though we're still looking at an inflation in the 20s, you know, 20, I mean, huge, it's unconceivable for people in the U.S. to think about inflation of 26% in a year or something. But in the time period, the average inflation during the last government that was in power before Chavez won, the Caldera government, was inflation, the average inflation was over 68%. So it's not, it's an inherited problem, something that's been going on for a long time because there's been, you know, severe economic problems. There's been a lot of corruption, mishandling of public funds, but there's also a sickness in Venezuela amongst the businesses that somehow feel as though speculation is legitimate. And so there are constant price hikes in speculation that then contribute to the inflation. I mean, it's like a vicious cycle. And the government is combating it. I mean, there are still problems, obviously, but there are serious efforts underway to get that situation under control. So the causes are, you know, long-term causes that have been in place, and there are efforts underway constantly to reduce that inflation. They've been successful, just, you know, not successful enough yet. Yes?
Is there any voice in Congress and our U.S. government, even like Bernie Sanders, or that at least gives a voice in opposition to the kind of, you know, lending walk of American government following the policy that Obama's taking?
Yeah, Bernie Sanders has never mentioned or been willing to get on the bandwagon of Venezuela or other countries in Latin America. There were a few Congress members that are now retired that were allies, Christopher Dodd, William Delahunt, who are gone. And there were a few other, Barbara Lee, who's also gone. Cynthia McKinney was the one who was there, who's an ally. Barbara Lee. Barbara Lee is actually one who's been a friend, as well as there are a few, Jose Serrano, but who have such a minimal voice that they haven't really been able to do anything. And now, of course, the situation is much worse because with the Republicans taking over the House, we've seen them now, the worst possible scenario has occurred, which is that the Congress members who have taken over the House Foreign Relations Committee and the Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere Affairs of the Foreign Relations Committee are like the most rabid anti-Chavez and anti-Alba leftist whatever Congress members, Ileana Rosletnin and Connie Mack, who are the, you know, two Florida Republicans. And so Ileana is leading the Foreign Relations Committee in the House, and Connie Mack is in charge of the Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere, which is Latin America. And they, in fact, hosted, they took those positions, which was this year, and when they took office this year in January, in November of last year, they hosted in the U.S. Capitol a conference called Danger in the Andes. And they invited a whole slew of, like, people that were involved, key leaders in the coup against Chavez, in the destabilization efforts and the separatism efforts against Evo in Bolivia, Lucio Gutierrez, who is an ex-president of Ecuador and was involved in the attempted coup against Correa in September of last year. And the topic of the meeting was precisely, you know, the threat and the danger that they perceive coming out of Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador, those three countries. And they talked about specifically a threat to inter-American security. And it was a meeting hosted in the U.S. Capitol, which gave it, you know, a pretty substantial level of legitimacy as something being, you know, obviously sanctioned or, you know, promoted by the U.S. Congress. And it occurred right around the same time that NATO had hosted a meeting, and NATO had put out some kind of declaration where the NATO countries said that if their interests were perceived, or if there was a threat to their security, NATO country security, or their interest security around the world, that they could act militarily. And for at least for me, the analysis that I made was that the similar type of language was employed in the case of, you know, this conference that took place in the U.S. Capitol, where they said the threat to inter-American security. And so that somehow, therefore, this was a justification for further action to be taken. When Connie Mack was sworn in as the head of the subcommittee of Western Hemisphere Affairs, he ridiculously, but, you know, again, dangerously made the statement that his one goal in that capacity would be to get Hugo Chavez. And Ileana, if you don't know who she is, she's a close friend of a notorious character known as Luis Posada Carriles, who's one of the, you know, a terrorist in Latin America who's now been given sanctuary in the United States in reward for his service to the CIA and the U.S. military throughout the latter half of the 20th century. But she's openly called for the assassination, not just of Fidel Castro, but also of Chavez, and has said anyone, actually, who threatens U.S. interests. She was one of the first out there applauding, of course, the scenario. Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, the U.S. She's a U.S. Congress member, Republican ranking, but she's the head of the Foreign Relations Committee of the House, Florida, Republican, Miami. So the answer is no. At this time, we have no allies in the U.S. There probably are allies, but no one's willing to put their, you know, behind out there to on the line for Latin America right now.
What sort of pressures would it be more strategically effective for Americans who are getting information in the U.S. to put pressure directly on Obama in whatever way, shape, or form? Because obviously everything has to go through him as far as legislation.
Well, I mean,
Republicans are obviously totally
intransigent. Yeah, the Obama situation, my own personal opinion of it, is that he doesn't really care about Latin America. He doesn't really know Latin America. He's not really interested in Latin America. And the advisors that he's surrounded by on Latin America are all the ones that have been running Latin American policy and, you know, U.S. policy towards Latin America for years. And he hasn't made any initiative to change that whatsoever. And in fact, has fallen in line with that. So trying to reach out directly to, they've tried. Chavez has tried to reach out directly to him. All kinds of initiatives have been undertaken to try to get information. They're just, you know, as long as those that are running the show continue to be the ones who are there, it's not going to change. At the same time, that doesn't mean there's nothing that can be done. I still believe that, yes, you should pressure your congresspeople. You should try to get the information there, especially, you know, not necessarily saying, hey, defend Chavez or anything like that, but the money factor is the key. It's your taxpayer dollars. It's the budget. No, I mean, they shouldn't approve a budget with $5 million in there allocated to fund groups in Venezuela. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, that's something you can take on without even having to get into the politics of whether you or not you like Chavez. You know, it's about, wait, where should our money be going, period? And it's a way to do that without having to involve them. Because it's unfortunately that the media campaign has been so successful that, you know, no one's really willing to get out there and anyone who gets out there and talks about Chavez, at this stage, it's like saying, you know, Osama bin Laden was extrajudicially assassinated. And by saying that, people will say, you support terrorists. So if you say, no, but, you know, Chavez is a Democrat, they're going to say, oh, well, you support terrorists. Basically, yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that the aggression is stepping up. And while oil production may have, I don't know if it's stalled, I don't know if I'd say that exactly. You know, what the reserves, for example, in Venezuela that have been certified as the largest in the world are a specific kind of It's a very heavy, heavy crude that has to be refined a certain way. It's not usable in right now or easily converted into a usable source of energy. It's a whole process that has to be undertaken, but it's a longer-term thing that they're looking at. And in fact, initially, those reserves were said to be bitumen, which is like a heavy kind of coal, and not a petroleum, not an oil. And that was said so by U.S. corporations that were in there exploiting it and trying to produce it and get it and, you know, take it for themselves. And that whole region was nationalized, actually, where those reserves are in 2007 as well. So I think that the U.S. has a long-term plan, exactly, where to get back Venezuela under their control. No question that it's seen more in the long term, and that there's definitely the fear because, for example, Venezuela already has agreements with China. Right now, they're supplying almost 500,000 barrels of oil a day to China. And the goal is by 2013 to increase that to 1 million. And that could continue to increase even more. You know, and now Venezuela also has the fifth largest reserves of gas in the world, of natural gas. We've seen now that Bolivia has the number one of lithium, for example, and also, major gas reserves. So the whole region is a target for that ravenous consumption, excessive consumption.
Is Venezuela, Iraq, Iran, other,
Libya? Libya has the largest oil reserves in Africa.
On a day-to-day basis, we're seeing this evolve.
That's right. That's why we're here talking about it. Yeah, I mean, for real. I believe that that's a... Otherwise, I wouldn't have dedicated my life to be doing this work for the past, like, 7, 8 years. If I didn't believe that it's a possibility. That can happen and that we want to prevent that from happening. That, it's a way of sort of saying, wait, that we can't see this, we can't allow this to happen again. This is crazy. And in a country where we know that, you know, there's a thriving, vibrant people building this incredible model of social justice. You know, how is it just because it's the bittersweet fortune of Venezuela that they're sitting on all that oil. And that they're using that because, you know what, here's another just little piece of data. Chavez just passed another law because the oil prices fluctuate all the time, and this year, because of last year, oil prices went down. Now they've gone back up because of the war against Libya, but last year they were down to like in the 30s and $40 a barrel. So the budget for this year, Venezuela's budget, was based on the oil price at $40 a barrel. Of course, today, actually, I was looking at the numbers, it's gone over, it's like $109 a barrel. So you can imagine that's a huge level of profit that's now coming into Venezuela. So Chavez just passed a law, it's called a windfall tax, where what it says is if oil goes over, because as of right now, around 60% of oil profits go to social spending. So are taken and are put in a special fund where then they're used to invest in social programs. And the windfall tax says that as oil prices increase, so if the oil price goes between $70 to $80 a barrel, then 70% will be invested in public spending. If it goes to 80 to 90, then it'll be 80%. And if it goes above $90 to $100 a barrel, then it'll be 90 to 95%. So almost 100% of profits are going to be going into social programs. So, yeah, I mean, it's incredible. It's great. Yes. Yes, in the back.
By the U.S. to get drugs here. That's one
Well, I live in Venezuela. I live in Caracas. I've been living there full time since 2005, but I've been living on and off in Venezuela for the past like 17 years. I lived there during the 90s before Chavez came to power and before the revolution started. So I've lived through the process of change and the transformation. I've seen it, I've witnessed it, I've lived it, which is why I feel privileged to be a witness to it as well as a participant of it and have a perspective that's an outsider-insider, you know, being from the outside but also the inside. And so now I live there full-time, but I have a new project, which is a TV show that I do a weekly show now with a – this is a totally bizarre scenario, but it's RT, which is Russia Today. It's a Russian, but they have a station in Spanish. They have a television station in Spanish, RT in Espanol. It's run out of Moscow, but it's transmitted. Actually, you can get it in some U.S. cities. You get it in New York, for example, and in a lot of Latin American countries and throughout Europe. So I'm doing a weekly show, a news analysis show for RT in Spanish, but it's out of a New York studio. It's totally crazy, but it's transmitted through Moscow anyway. So I go up about once a month now to New York, but that's a new thing since January. But otherwise, I'm in Venezuela most of the time, living there. And what would I like to see come out of this? Well, I mean, my principal goal, of course, is raising consciousness and trying to get the word out there about what's really going on in Venezuela and more so to people of the U.S. to really, you know, get people to understand the threat and the danger that the U.S. government represents to the peoples of Latin America today, and particularly to Venezuela, but of course to all the nations that are undergoing these processes of change, which are mainly the countries that comprise ALBA. And the funding angle to me is key, because that's been like one of my main areas of work is stop the funding, you know, of this kind of feeding the conflict. And I'm proud to say that because of my work, we got the law passed in Venezuela that prohibits that funding and that USAID left. Of course, they're still going to continue to fund, but it does show that, you know, you can, with persistence and determination, you know, you can defeat the empire and U.S. power every now and then. So I would like to see, I would like to see more efforts come out of the people of the U.S. to stop that kind of funding. Because again, it's your taxpayer dollars, you know, going into that, into those initiatives. And yeah, for more people to understand what's happening. And to look for other sources of information. I run a newspaper, the only English language newspaper out of Venezuela. It's a weekly. There were some copies out there. I don't know if they're still there. The Correo del Orinoco. It's the name in Spanish because they didn't want to change the name. I tried to get it to be Orinoco, which is a river in Venezuela. And actually, the name it's Correo del Orinoco, which means the Orinoco Post. It's the river Orinoco. And the name was the original newspaper that Simón Bolívar created 200 years ago. And it was actually distributed not just in Spanish, but also in French and in English to the islands of the Caribbean, because he played a role also in the independence movement throughout the region and believed in this concept of integration that included the Caribbean. So it was Chavez's initiative. It's our newspaper of the revolution to start it first in Spanish and then to do it in other languages. So I'm just explaining why it's called the Correo del Orinoco International. But again, it's a source of information in English that you can get, and you know, I distribute it online as well, and to get that information out to people in the U.S. to understand what's going on and to not just see or think all the time about Venezuela as Chavez. And just in that way, but to see that it's really a people's movement. I mean, there's incredibly fascinating stuff going on with community councils and cooperatives, you know, and different, all kinds of developments. I mean, and even regionally, we just created a regional currency called the Sucre, which is a virtual currency that's now being used amongst ALBA nations for commerce and trade. So, because before it's always, and it still is amongst all the other countries, it's the dollar. It's crazy. So now we have our own currency, and it's virtual, and we can use it to, you know, between our countries to trade and not have to go through the U.S. dollar. I mean, even though it may sound trivial, it's a huge development in terms of economic independence in the region. So, I mean, all kinds of things like that we try to put out in the newspaper, you know, to show what's really happening on the ground. And talk about. So to get that information out there, I mean, combat and debunk the myths that are out there about what's happening in Venezuela. And also, again, eventually, you know, overall, to prevent any kind of further direct aggression or military intervention against Venezuela or any country in Latin America. Just on the drug trafficking note, I'd say, one, Venezuela produces no drugs. It's not a drug production company, but it's next to the largest producing country of drugs, of cocaine, in the world, which is Colombia. So Venezuela has been victim of Colombia's drug war, which, of course, is a country that's also heavily occupied by the U.S. military and their war on drugs. But in fact, since Plan Colombia began, the drug production has actually increased. And so, you know, in some ways it's seen as an effort, again, to one of the angles that's used to undermine and sabotage the Chavez government and try to make this link with drug trafficking. But Venezuela is not a country that is producing those drugs. So a lot of times when they say, oh, it's coming out of Venezuela, it's actually coming out of Colombia, and they may have flown through or over Venezuela. But it's all coming from Colombia. It's not coming from Venezuela. And yes, in the end, you know, if there wasn't the consumption here, then it wouldn't be produced and coming out of there. So that's the hypocrisy of the U.S. war on drugs, is that, you know, it feeds the consumption anyway and allows for it to take place here in the U.S. and so therefore promotes it and encourages it in other countries. Yes, ma'am. I am? RT.
Congratulations. I'm glad that you're informing people, and I hope that with New York, maybe you'll be more of a regular contributor to, I don't know, Democracy Now! You're on Flashpoint, or Kibu. I hear about you more and more, and it's really good to see that. I feel like even like Al Jazeera has more, this kind of knowledge is coming out to the mainstream, and I know more and more people will see it on Congratulations.
Thank you.
Sorry I blurted out the NGO thing. I think it was PTSD. But I had this sense of shame from the past of, like, spending, you know, most of my life being manipulated by our education, you know, our media and education, and lived 10 years in Eastern Europe, and really it was a part of this whole USA. I mean, I watched it happen there, and I watched it happen elsewhere, and it's just killing me that it's happening in Central and South America with the NGOs. You know, they just taught us in school that it's all about whack-a-mole and follow the money. It would have been so easy. We wouldn't have wasted all this time on education. And I came back just in time for 9/11, and I've been here 10 years. It's been bizarre. It's been so bizarre. And I'm really glad that you have this connection between the two countries, because it helps people to understand more. So thank you. And thank you for addressing the NGO issue as well. So I don't know about the Tea Party, really, but I am glad that they start to see that funding into other countries is sometimes is questionable. And it's sad that humanitarian aid can't be all about helping people in need, you know, like medically, but some of this humanitarian aid is very questionable. And at least with this Congress, I don't know, how do you see that with the foreign aid being cut?
Well, I don't. I mean, as of
Venezuela is getting more, actually, right?
That's the budget request that's been made by Obama. Has it been approved yet? With the Tea Party, it's just Ron Paul. He's the only one. He actually like publishes my articles sometimes on his website. It's funny, but yeah, he is totally opposed. He wants the NED shut down, for example. He's opposed to all of that, which is a good thing. I mean, I think that's. I like that. I mean, I don't support his other policies, but that's a good part of it, of his policies, is that he's opposed to U.S. taxpayer dollars and public funds being given to fund political activities abroad. And I think that's obviously, I agree with that opinion. I think that the scenario as it was just days ago has changed dramatically. And that while maybe there had been a possibility that less emphasis because of a debilitated Obama administration 1 week ago would have had on conducting or further increasing any kind of aggression against other nations, that wouldn't have happened before Sunday. That now things have changed because he's pumped up. You know, they're pumped up again with the war machine. He's a hero. He's a strong war president now. So it can't just stop there. He's in a campaign. He just launched a campaign. So there's got to be another target. It can't just stop there. And at the same time, you know, the threat, as they say, is increasing because of what's happened, that it's everywhere, the unseen enemy, the limitless battlefield, and that somehow that, yeah, I think that what could have been a decrease in that type of activity is now going to change, that it's going to continue on the path that it was on, of the escalation in aggression. And that they're definitely looking towards Latin America, and that they're actively trying to make a link with the terrorism aspect particularly. You know, not the drug trafficking, whatever. I mean, that's not a reason for, except in the case of course, Panama. But that was amongst other issues. But I think it's really the terrorism issue. And that they're, you know, Venezuela and Chavez is not going to, you know, the Chavez administration is not going to change its position on absolutely anything because of the increased aggression. In fact, it's going to become even stronger. And, I mean, Venezuela put out a statement in regards to the killing of Osama bin Laden, that while recognizing and expressing sympathies for the victims of September 11, 2001, you know, rejected fully the concept of, you know, violations of sovereignty and extrajudicial killings, and of course called once again immediately for the deoccupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and every other country that the U.S. is military intervening in, and the ceasing of violating people's rights around the world. And the same in the case of Libya, you know, and that Venezuela has been, and I mean, you guys probably saw it in the media, Chavez was one of the first presidents to come out against the aggression towards Libya. And what happened immediately? Oh, well, that's because Chavez is supporting Gaddafi and they're all terrorists. You know, that's what was said. No, Venezuela has a consistent foreign policy. You can look at it with regards to anything. If there's something takes place in Russia or wherever, you know, Venezuela has the same policy. Venezuela is anti-imperialist, anti-interventionist, against aggression, pro-peace. You know, pro-people. And so we'll continue to have that policy. And so I think that that's something, you know, that's going to confront more so and more so this government as it's going to continue now to increase its and keep its... I mean, Obama's not going to want to let himself deflate after what's happened. He was already deflated, you know? So he's going to look for ways to continue to increase that. And I just wanted to comment on the NGO factor because it's really a terrible situation. You know, an NGO is a non-governmental organization, and obviously you guys know that, but now the concept of NGOs has been severely perverted by the U.S. government. And in 2003, the U.S. aid administrator made a statement in some event he was speaking at where he said, NGOs are an important arm of the U.S. government, which is it's a perverted statement, but it's true. And how they've been and using more so and more so NGOs to promote their agenda and
the Europe in the 90s.
Yeah. And how, well, because it's become one of the most effective ways. And that in fact in 2009 there was a doctrine of counterinsurgency published by the US government that Obama signed into whatever official doctrine. And it's a alliance of USAID, Department of State, and Pentagon. A triangle. They put it out as a triangle. And even though USAID is a branch of, it's a division of the State Department, it's now really becoming its own entity, growing more and more. And, I mean, it's a pretty serious concept to think that there's a doctrine of counterinsurgency that's involving USAID. And what they're talking about is, well, there are three, the axis is, State Department is the diplomacy angle. The Pentagon, of course, is the military angle. You know, the military forces, if we're thinking about, like, think about it as, whatever, Afghanistan. You know, the military forces, the diplomacy part, whatever they're dealing with publicly and directly with that government, and, you know, how they're expressing it to the people. And then USAID is the so-called economic and democracy promotion part, which is the one that's working on the ground with the NGOs and other entities, you know, to further the agenda. But how it's viewed officially from U.S. doctrine as a counterinsurgency strategy, You know, I mean, when I saw that, I thought, whoa, this is serious stuff. You know, can you imagine? I mean, then how can you justify U.S. aid funding in a country to an NGO when they're part of a counterinsurgency doctrine? I mean, it's crazy. But that's the extent that it's gotten to, and how they've come to see that it's really one of the most effective ways to promote U.S. agenda is through an NGO. Because it's a way where you can't, it's more difficult to detect and decipher the U.S. fingerprints when it's coming through, you know, a third-party entity that appears to be an independent and, in general, you know, an entity working towards some kind of human rights or social development. But how, in the end, behind that entity are the same actors who've been involved in destabilization and promoting regime change. Yes. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about what's happening with the workers' movement? I mean, I know when I was there, there was this great unionization drive happening with the new Labor Federation, but then it seems like it's split up since then. There's infighting, but also there's this whole expansion of co-ops, and then there's this workers' control movement, both in the private sector and the multinational sector and the public sector. Can you talk about what's happening?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but what I can say is that, yes, there were problems with, you know, there was a new federation that was created, the UNITE, and then there was a lot of bickering with it and stuff. But because now we're embarking on presidential campaign for 2012, in fact, just this May Day, which was the Workers' March, all the different unions and federations that support the revolution came out to officially announce their support for Chavez's candidacy and to reunite again. And so there are initiatives underway now to reunite the unions, you know, unify them again under the federation of whatever, whichever one it's going to be. To work through that scenario of the difficulties that were taking place. There are other stuff is happening in terms of the workers' control. Factories are advancing and the industries. In fact, all of the new companies that the government has expropriated or nationalized are worker-run companies, are being converted into worker-run companies. So I think I was mentioning to you before a supermarket chain that, you know, beyond some of the subsidized food programs that were created a few years ago to combat inflation and speculation, the Mercal and Pedeval, some programs where, you know, there are little markets set up to sell products at very low costs. The government last year, was a really difficult year in Venezuela because we had a drought that caused a severe energy crisis, despite the fact that Venezuela is this large oil producer. It's 75% dependent on hydroelectric energy. And so with the drought, what happened was, you know, the reserves, the reservoirs, the dams, everything went down. And so on the border of collapse, of a complete collapse, the government implemented rationing. So it was really serious. I mean, we went through 6 months of energy rationing, and that energy means also water because the water systems are generated through electrical energy. So, you know, it was hard going through. Anyway, at the same time, there were economic problems. We had a banking crisis at the beginning of last year as well. There were 11 banks were intervened that were on the verge of collapse because of the economic crisis, or that were mishandling funds. That, you know, there was corruption going on, so the government intervened, 11 banks, and to the contrary of what happened in the U.S. when the banking crisis took place just over the past couple of years, where the government intervened, and what exactly did they do? Didn't they give, like, $900 billion or $700, some massive amount of money to the bankers and financial institutions, right? Isn't that what they did? Yeah. But what happened to all the people and their money and their homes and that kind of stuff? They didn't do anything about that. Okay, so in the case of Venezuela, the government intervened in the banks and guaranteed all customer savings so that nobody lost a cent or a bolívar. And in the case of banks that were totally corrupted from within, that there was no hope in salvaging, they just liquidated them. And then in the case of those that could be salvaged, but that they determined all these irregularities, they were nationalized. And the owners of those banks, of course, fled the country, fled justice, because they stole money. They stole, you know, millions of dollars, and they're hanging out in Miami. They're all in Miami, actually, right now. Anyway, I'm explaining that because there was an economic crisis, and the economic crisis caused what a gentleman who's there is no longer there who asked about the inflation situation caused, you know, inflation and speculation, and a lot of the supermarkets and product distribution companies began to either hoard products, which has been an ongoing strategy used to create social turmoil in Venezuela, or to just, you know, to spike prices. And so the government said, wait a minute, if you're going to do that, you know, it's against the law, we will expropriate. And so they ended up expropriating one of the largest supermarket chains in the country, which was Cada, and they turned it into the bicentennial markets. And so now the bicentennial supermarkets, which are huge, they're like giant supermarkets, are worker-run. So the same workers that worked there before, which is pretty cool. I mean, they're not. It's not like they said, all right, all of you get out of here, and now we're going to fill it with Chavistas or whatever. No, the same workers who were there before are now running that company, that market. It's now they're socialist companies. So there's a very cool process. And they may not necessarily be part of unions, you know, that belong to the Federation. But, yeah, there's all kinds of developments in that area of worker-run businesses, the new socialist companies, the cooperatives. I mean, we've got thousands of cooperatives now nationwide, and we're trying to build these, you know, beyond the community councils, connecting them to what we're calling the communes, and within which are like, you know, groupings of community councils in different regions, and so that every commune, you know, comuna, will have cooperatives that then work within that region in whatever that, you know, whatever they produce, whatever industries they have, that will then contribute to the development of those communities or that commune. But then they can also interact with the other one. I mean, that's sort of the long-term goal of what's taking place right now, is that eventually it's this idealistic utopia, right? That eventually all the power will be transferred down from the state institutions. So, you know, take out the middleman, take out the bureaucracy. Everything will be run. The resources will be managed by every community or every commune. And that's the way business will be done. And, you know, exchange will be conducted in the country. Yeah, it's cool. We'll see if it works. Yeah. Oh. That's it? Well, I called on her over.
quick comment, quick question.
We could take yours.
Thank you very much for sharing your extraordinary energy. And
thanks.
Clear insights with us. It's like seeing a starburst to hear the truth. It's so very rare. My question is, you've answered it partly with reference to Washington Television, which I'll have to look up and learn about, because that's really something.
The New York Times did a whole profile on me, but I'll tell you, it was, yeah, but it was not exactly how I would have liked it to have come out. Yeah, that was like a month and a half ago, and that piece was picked up around the world in almost every major newspaper. But yeah, they turned, you know, it was like, what was it? The headline is, an American has the ear with Chavez's ear. I don't know, something like that. But they tried to turn me into the propagandist for dictators. Because it was after I'd come back, I mentioned I went to Libya with Chavez, but it was actually a whole trip around the axis. I called it the Axis of Evil tour, because we went to Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, Iran, Syria, Libya. Yeah, I know. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, there have been some, but none of the, not the TV stuff, no. I've done, well, CNN, like CNN in Spanish, stuff like that. But they're all Chavez haters. New York Times hates Chavez. Washington Post, forget it. Yeah, most of that media. And unfortunately, Democracy Now, even though they've done stuff, I mean, and Amy does reporting occasionally. She's not very interested in Latin America. Yeah. Only, what I was told once was, if there's another coup, we'll definitely interview you. Thanks. We're trying to avoid that. From happening. We'll take his question.
I was just wondering if you could just point out the recent collaboration in Venezuela with Paul Warren for the Colombian radical metal situation. A little bit confusing.
All right. Well, there is a situation, and probably everyone doesn't know about that, but just recently an individual who runs a website called Ankle, which is a website, and a Colombian website that's talks or writes primarily about the civil war conflict in the country, but is also favorable towards the FARC, ANCOL. And the head of ANCOL was run by a Colombian guy who got asylum and refuge in Sweden and eventually renounced his Colombian citizenship and had been living in Sweden for years and as a Swedish citizen, and was invited to Venezuela by somebody, non-governmental for something, got on a plane last week from Sweden, went through Frankfurt Airport on Lufthansa, and when he got to Caracas, he was detained and deported to Colombia. And this caused a huge controversy because, you know, this guy's a journalist. He's not a member of the FARC. Colombia said that he was a terrorist, you know, guerrilla, whatever. And the fact that Venezuela just did that angered a lot of people on the left. What happened is the following. Chavez got a phone call from President Santos. Chavez told the story, so, you know, I'm not giving out any classified information here. He told it publicly. Santos called him up and said, this guy who's wanted, we have an Interpol red alert out for this guy, Joaquin Perez Becerra. He's on a plane right now, on the Lufthansa plane, sitting in this seat. He's only got hand luggage, and he's arriving in Caracas at this time. Please, you know, send him to us. We've got a warrant out for him. And so Chavez said, all right, no problem. Because they have an agreement now that ties are being mended, you know, that Venezuela is going to fully collaborate, as it had been before, but still it's more, you know, officialized with that situation with Colombia, and that Venezuela is not going to harbor anybody who's wanted internationally because Venezuela is trying to get its criminals all around the world and no one's giving them up. So if Venezuela doesn't do it, you know, it's a hypocritical policy. If we don't, just like U.S. policy is all hypocritical, Colombia's is hypocritical, but Venezuela's is not. So Venezuela said, look, you know, we're going to abide by the law. The decision, so that was the decision. So the guy, when the guy arrives in the airport, the order had already been given by the president to the security forces. They said, you know, he comes in, they swipe the passport, this is the guy, you're detained, you're sent over, that's it. He was out within a matter of hours. And, I mean, it was a terrible situation because, I mean, my own personal opinion is that there should have been at least a minimal reflection made or questioning of who is the guy. And had they looked up and seen that he's a journalist and that he's not a FARC terrorist, that it could have changed the scenario, but probably not, because, I mean, Chavez made it really clear. He said, look, we're going to abide by the law, I mean, international law. This is our obligation. It's really an unfortunate situation. And at the same time, Chavez made it really clear that it was a setup. It was a total setup, because if the guy had an Interpol red alert out, they should have gotten him in Frankfurt. I mean, Germany, come on, has like one of the most efficient security apparatuses. And that airport is one of the most modern and, you know, most secure in the world. So it was a setup. No one knows exactly, it hasn't been fully disclosed whether or not the red alert existed before he got on the plane or after. My own opinion is that Santos did it as a test. It was a setup for Chavez to see, is he going to do it or is he not going to do it? You know, is he going to send us the guy or not? And, you know, I mean, Chavez did what he felt like he had to do legally. But it's a terrible situation because now this guy's going to face, like, torture and imprisonment in Colombia. And he's not a terrorist. He's, a journalist. So. Diplomacy. Yes? Should I take another question? I don't know what to do.
Yes.
They're all telling me no. All right, one more. Oh. I'll take another. I mean, yeah, I don't know what to do because there are two questions. I don't want to say. All right, go ahead. We'll make it quick. Let's make it quick. Everyone's leaving.
I was wondering how much the rise of Brazil and Lula da Silva and the president of Brazil, Lula was a leftist and the president was a former guerrilla that was imprisoned and tortured. How much the rise of Brazil as a regional and a world power has provided coverage and protection?
Wait, Brazil?
Yeah. As a
Well, I mean, Brazil has played a key role in the efforts towards Latin American integration, and of course, under Lula's presidency, Lula himself, Luis Ignacio da Silva, refused the U.S. pressures to try to take a stance against Venezuela. You know, the WikiLeaks documents, State Department documents that were obtained by WikiLeaks disclosed that the U.S. engaged in ongoing efforts throughout Lula's entire administration to try to turn him against Chavez, and that they were never successful. I don't think it'll happen with Dilma either, but Brazil has a really close relationship, and of course we saw that, you know, Obama went to Brazil first, and Dilma had meetings with Obama before she's met with Chavez. So those types of things are signs about what can happen along the lines. And of course, Brazil is trying to get a seat on the permanent seat on the UN Security Council. And so, you know, they've got their own interests going on. But yeah, I mean, Brazil plays a really important role. But I wouldn't say that. And Brazil has certainly distanced itself from ALBA and, you know, the more sort of leftist initiatives throughout Latin America, and they're trying to play it, you know, as an they're trying to play a role as an international economic leader. So, you know, we always have to. Yeah, every country's got their own interest. I mean, when it comes to Venezuela, we know we can count on basically two countries. If it comes down to it, who's going to be there? Cuba and Bolivia. That's it. The rest of them have all China, Russia. Everyone's got their interests. Everyone else. Fiend? Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Before you go, I passed out these little packets on this side. We have a quick and dirty action alert about what's going on in Honduras right now, because the situation is really serious while this Honduras is Open for Business conference is going on, headlined by Alvaro Uribe and Bill Clinton. So the situation on the ground for organizers there is really serious, and we have a little action alert.